personal nature, that customers, not managers, essentially control the investment patterns of a company. By contrast, managers who choose the second option align themselves with this tendency, harnessing rather than fighting its power. The cases presented in this chapter provide strong evidence that the second option offers far higher probabilities of success than the first. Innovation and resource allocation. The mechanism through which customers control the investments of a firm is the resource allocation process, the process that determines which initiatives get staff and money and which don't. Resource allocation and innovation are two sides of the same coin. Only those new product development projects that do get adequate funding, staffing, and management attention have a chance to succeed. Those that are starved of resources will languish. Hence, the patterns of innovation in a company will mirror quite closely the patterns in which resources are allocated. Good resource allocation processes are designed to weed out proposals that customers don't want. When these decision-making processes work well, if customers don't want a product, it won't get funded. If they do want it, it will. This is how things must work in great companies. They must invest in things customers want, and the better they become at doing this, the more successful they will be. As we heard in Chapter 4, resource allocation is not simply a matter of top-down decision-making followed by implementation. Typically, senior managers are asked to decide whether to fund a project only after many others at lower levels in the organization have already decided which types of project proposals they want to package and send on to senior management for approval, and which they don't think are worth the effort. Senior managers typically see only a well-screened subset of the innovative ideas generated. And even after senior management has endorsed funding for a particular project, it is rarely a done deal. Many crucial resource allocation decisions are made after project approval, indeed after product launch, by mid-level managers who set priorities when multiple projects and products compete for the time of the same people, equipment, and vendors. As management scholar Chester Barnard has noted, from the point of view of the relative importance of specific decisions, those of executives properly call for first attention. But from the point of view of aggregate importance, it is not decisions of executives, but of non-executive participants in organizations which should enlist major interest. So, how do non-executive participants make their resource allocation decisions? They decide which projects they will propose to senior management and which they will give priority to, based upon their understanding of what types of customers and products are most profitable to the company. Tightly coupled with this is their view of how their sponsorship of different proposals will affect their own career trajectories within the company, a view that is formed heavily by their understanding of what customers want and what types of products the company needs to sell more of in order to be more profitable. Individuals' career trajectories can soar when they sponsor highly profitable innovation programs. It is through these mechanisms of seeking corporate profit and personal success, therefore, that customers exert a profound influence on the process of resource allocation, and hence on the patterns of innovation in most companies. Success in disruptive disk drive technology. It is possible to break out of this system of customer control, however. Three cases in the history of the disk drive industry demonstrate how managers can develop strong market positions in a disruptive technology. In two cases, managers harnessed, rather than fought, the forces of resource dependence. They spun out independent companies to commercialize the disruptive technology. In the third, the manager chose to fight these forces and survived the project exhausted. Quantum and Plus Development. As we have heard, Quantum Corporation, a leading maker of 8-inch drives sold in the mini computer market in the early 1980s, completely missed the advent of 5.25-inch drives. It introduced its first versions nearly 4 years after those drives first appeared in the market. As the 5.25-inch pioneers began to invade the mini-computer market from below, for all the reasons already described, Quantum's sales began to sag. In 1984, several Quantum employees saw a potential market for a thin 3.5-inch drive plugged into an expansion slot in IBM XT and AT-class desktop computers, drives that would be sold to personal computer users rather than the OEM mini-computer manufacturers that had accounted for all of Quantum's revenue. They determined to leave Quantum and start a new firm to commercialize their idea. Rather than let them leave unencumbered, however, Quantum's executives financed and retained 80% ownership of this spin-off venture, called Plus Development Corporation, and set the company up in different facilities. It was a completely self-sufficient organization, with its own executive staff and all of the functional capabilities required in an independent company. Plus was extremely successful. It designed and marketed its drives, but had them manufactured under contract by Matsushita Kotobuki Electronics, MKE, in Japan. As sales of Quantum's line of 8-inch drives began to evaporate in the mid-1980s, they were offset by Plus's growing hard card revenues. By 1987, sales of Quantum's 8 and 5.25-inch products had largely disappeared. Quantum then purchased the remaining 20% of Plus, essentially closed down the old corporation, and installed Plus's executives in Quantum's most senior positions. They then reconfigured Plus's 3.5-inch products to appeal to OEM desktop computer makers, such as Apple. Just as the capacity vector for 3.5-inch drives was invading the desktop market. Quantum, thus reconstituted as a 3.5-inch drive maker, has aggressively adopted sustaining component technology innovations, moving upmarket toward engineering workstations, and has also successfully negotiated the sustaining architectural innovation into 2.5-inch drives. By 1994, the new Quantum had become the largest unit volume producer of disk drives in the world. Control Data in Oklahoma. Control Data Corporation, CDC, effected the same self-reconstitution once. CDC was the dominant manufacturer of 14-inch drives sold into the OEM market between 1965 and 1982. Its market share fluctuated between 55 and 62%. When the 8-inch architecture emerged in the late 1970s, however, CDC missed it by 3 years. The company never captured more than a fraction of the 8-inch market, and those 8-inch drives that it did sell were sold almost exclusively to defend its established customer base of mainframe computer manufacturers. The reason was resources and managerial emphasis. Engineers and marketers at the company's principal Minneapolis facility kept getting pulled off the 8-inch program to resolve problems in the launch of next-generation 14-inch products for CDC's mainstream customers. CDC launched its first 5.25-inch model 2 years after Seagate's pioneering product appeared in 1980. This time, however, CDC located its 5.25-inch effort in Oklahoma City. This was done, according to one manager, not to escape CDC's Minneapolis engineering culture, but to isolate the 5.25-inch product group from the company's mainstream customers. Although it was late in the market and never regained its former dominant position, CDC's foray into 5.25-inch drives was profitable, and at times the firm commanded a 20% share of higher capacity 5.25-inch drives. Micropolis. Transition by managerial force. Micropolis Corporation, an early disk drive leader founded in 1978 to make 8-inch drives, was the only other industry player to successfully make the transition to a disruptive platform. It did not use the spin-out strategy that had worked for Quantum and Control Data, however, choosing instead to manage the change from within the mainstream company. But even this exception supports the rule that customers exert exceptionally powerful influence over the investments that firms can undertake successfully. Micropolis began to change in 1982, when founder and CEO Stuart Mabon intuitively perceived the trajectories of market demand and technology supply and decided that the firm should become primarily a maker of 5.25-inch drives. While initially hoping to keep adequate resources focused on developing its next generation of 8-inch drives so that Micropolis could straddle both markets, he assigned the company's premier engineers to the 5.25-inch program. Mabon recalls that it took 100% of my time and energy for 18 months to keep adequate resources focused on the 5.25-inch program because the organization's own mechanisms allocated resources to where the customers were, 8-inch drives. By 1984, Micropolis had failed to keep pace with competition in the mini-computer market for disk drives and withdrew its remaining 8-inch models. With Herculean effort, however, it did succeed in its 5.25-inch programs. In making the transition, Micropolis assumed a position on a very different technological trajectory. It had to walk away from every one of its major customers and replace the lost revenues with sales of the new product line to an entirely different group of desktop computer makers. Mabon remembers the experience as the most exhausting of his life. Micropolis finally introduced a 3.5-inch product in 1993. That was the point at which the product had progressed to pack more than 1 gigabyte in the 3.5-inch platform. At that level, Micropolis could sell the 3.5-inch drive to its existing customers. Disruptive technologies and the theory of resource dependence. The struggles recounted earlier of Seagate Technology's attempts to sell 3.5-inch drives and of Bucyrus Erie's failed attempt to sell its early HydroHo only to its mainstream customers illustrate how the theory of resource dependence can be applied to cases of disruptive technologies. In both instances, Seagate and Bucyrus were among the first in their industries to develop these disruptive products. But despite senior managers' decisions to introduce them, the impetus or organizational energy required to launch the products aggressively into the appropriate value networks simply did not coalesce until customers needed them. Should we then accept the corollary stipulated by resource dependence theorists that managers are merely powerless individuals? Hardly. In the introduction, exploring the image of how people learn to fly, I noted that all attempts had ended in failure as long as they consisted of fighting fundamental laws of nature. But once laws such as gravity, Bernoulli's principle, and the notions of lift, drag, and resistance began to be understood, and flying machines were designed that accounted for or harnessed those laws, people flew quite successfully. By analogy, this is what quantum and control data did. By embedding independent organizations within an entirely different value network, where they were dependent upon the appropriate set of customers for survival, those managers harnessed the powerful forces of resource dependence. The CEO of Micropolis fought them, but he won a rare and costly victory. Disruptive technologies have had deadly impact in many industries, besides disk drives, mechanical excavators, and steel. The following will summarize the effect of disruptive technologies in three other industries: computers, retailing, and printers, to highlight how the only companies in those industries that established strong market positions in the disruptive technologies were those which, like quantum and control data, harnessed rather than fought the forces of resource dependence.
DEC, IBM, and the personal computer. Quite naturally, the computer industry and the disk drive industry have parallel histories, because value networks of the latter are embedded in those of the former. In fact, if the axes and intersecting trajectories depicted on the disk drive trajectory map in one chart were relabeled with computer-relevant terms, it would summarize equally well the failure of leading computer industry firms. IBM, the industry's first leader, sold its mainframe computers to the central accounting and data processing departments of large organizations. The emergence of the minicomputer represented a disruptive technology to IBM and its competitors. Their customers had no use for it. It promised lower, not higher margins, and the market initially was significantly smaller. As a result, the makers of mainframes ignored the minicomputers for years, allowing a set of entrants, Digital Equipment, Data General, Prime, Wang, and Nixdorf, to create and dominate that market. IBM ultimately introduced its own line of minicomputers, but it did so primarily as a defensive measure. When the capabilities of minicomputers had advanced to the point that they were performance competitive with the computing needs of some of IBM's customers. Similarly, none of the makers of minicomputers became a significant factor in the desktop personal computer market because to them, the desktop computer was a disruptive technology. The PC market was created by another set of entrants, including Apple, Commodore, Tandy, and IBM. The minicomputer makers were exceptionally prosperous and highly regarded by investors, the business press, and students of good management until the late 1980s, when the technological trajectory of the desktop computer intersected with the performance demanded by those who had previously bought minicomputers. The missile-like attack of the desktop computer from below severely wounded every minicomputer maker. Several of them failed. None established a viable position in the desktop personal computer value network. A similar sequence of events characterized the emergence of the portable computer, where the market was created and dominated by a set of entrants like Toshiba, Sharp, and Zenith. Apple and IBM, the leading desktop makers, did not introduce portable models until the portable's performance trajectory intersected with the computing needs of their customers. Probably none of these firms has been so deeply wounded by disruptive technology as Digital Equipment. DEC fell from fortune to folly in just a few years, as standalone workstations and networked desktop computers obviated most customers' needs for minicomputers almost overnight. DEC didn't stumble for lack of trying, of course. Four times between 1983 and 1995, it introduced lines of personal computers targeted at consumers, products that were technologically much simpler than DEC's minicomputers. But four times it failed to build businesses in this value network that were perceived within the company as profitable. Four times it withdrew from the personal computer market. Why? DEC launched all four forays from within the mainstream company. For all of the reasons so far recounted, even though executive-level decisions lay behind the move into the PC business, those who made the day-to-day resource allocation decisions in the company never saw the sense in investing the necessary money, time, and energy in low-margin products that their customers didn't want. Higher-performance initiatives that promised upscale margins, such as DEC's super-fast Alpha microprocessor and its adventure into mainframe computers, captured the resources instead. In trying to enter the desktop personal computing business from within its mainstream organization, DEC was forced to straddle the two different cost structures intrinsic to two different value networks. It simply couldn't hack away enough overhead cost to be competitive in low-end personal computers because it needed those costs to remain competitive in its higher performance products. Yet IBM's success in the first 5 years of the personal computing industry stands in stark contrast to the failure of the other leading mainframe and mini computer makers to catch the disruptive desktop computing wave. How did IBM do it? It created an autonomous organization in Florida, far away from its New York State headquarters, that was free to procure components from any source, to sell through its own channels, and to forge a cost structure appropriate to the technological and competitive requirements of the personal computing market. The organization was free to succeed along metrics of success that were relevant to the personal computing market. In fact, some have argued that IBM's subsequent decision to link its personal computer division much more closely to its mainstream organization was an important factor in IBM's difficulties in maintaining its profitability and market share in the personal computer industry. It seems to be very difficult to manage the peaceful unambiguous coexistence of two cost structures and two models for how to make money within a single company. The conclusion that a single organization might simply be incapable of competently pursuing disruptive technology while remaining competitive in mainstream markets bothers some can-do managers. And in fact, most managers try to do exactly what Micropolis and DEC did: maintain their competitive intensity in the mainstream while simultaneously trying to pursue disruptive technology. The evidence is strong that such efforts rarely succeed. Position in one market will suffer unless two separate organizations, embedded within the appropriate value networks, pursue their separate customers. Kresge, Woolworth, and Discount Retailing. In few industries has the impact of disruptive technology been felt so pervasively as in retailing, where discounters seized dominance from traditional department and variety stores. The technology of discount retailing was disruptive to traditional operations because the quality of service and selection offered by discounters played havoc with the accustomed metrics of quality retailing. Moreover, the cost structure required to compete profitably in discount retailing was fundamentally different than that which department stores had developed to compete within their value networks. The first discount store was Corvette's, which began operating a number of outlets in New York in the mid-1950s. Corvette's and its imitators operated at the very low end of retailing's product line, selling nationally known brands of standard hard goods at 20% to 40% below department store prices. They focused on products that sold themselves because customers already knew how to use them. Relying on national brand image to establish the value and quality of their products, these discounters eliminated the need for knowledgeable salespeople. They also focused on the group of customers least attractive to mainstream retailers: young wives of blue-collar workers with young children. This was counter to the upscale formulas department stores historically had used to define quality retailing and to improve profits. Discounters didn't accept lower profits than those of traditional retailers, however. They just earned their profits through a different formula. In the simplest terms, retailers cover their costs through the gross margin, or markup, they charge over the cost of the merchandise they sell. Traditional department stores historically marked merchandise up by 40% and turned their inventory over 4 times in a year. That is, they earned 40% on the amount they invested in inventory, 4 times during the year, for a total return on inventory investment of 160%. Variety stores earned somewhat lower profits through a formula similar to that used by the department stores. Discount retailers earned a return on inventory investment similar to that of department stores, but through a different model: low gross margins and high inventory turns. The following study summarizes the three positions. Retailer type: department stores. Company example: R.H. Macy. Typical gross margins 40%, typical inventory turns 4 times, return on inventory investment 160%. Retailer type: variety stores. Company example: F.W. Woolworth. Typical gross margins 36%, typical inventory turns 4 times, return on inventory investment 144%. Retailer type: discount retailers. Company example: Kmart. Typical gross margins 20%, typical inventory turns 8 times, return on inventory investment 160%. The history of discount retailing vividly recalls the history of mini-mill steel making. Just like the mini-mills, discounters took advantage of their cost structure to move up market and seize share from competing traditional retailers at a stunning rate. First at the low end, in brand name hard goods such as hardware, small appliances, and luggage, and later in territory further to the northeast, such as home furnishings and clothing. One study illustrates how stunning the discounters' invasion was. Their share of retailing revenues in the categories of goods they sold rose from 10% in 1960 to nearly 40% a scant 6 years later.
Just as in disk drives and excavators, a few of the leading traditional retailers, notably S.S. Kresge, F.W. Woolworth, and Dayton Hudson, saw the disruptive approach coming and invested early. None of the other major retail chains, including Sears, Montgomery Ward, J.C. Penney, and R.H. Macy, made a significant attempt to create a business in discount retailing. Kresge, with its Kmart chain, and Dayton Hudson, with the Target chain, succeeded. They both created focused discount retailing organizations that were independent from their traditional business. They recognized and harnessed the forces of resource dependence. By contrast, Woolworth failed in its venture, Woolco, trying to launch it from within the F.W. Woolworth Variety Store Company. A detailed comparison of the approaches of Kresge and Woolworth, which started from very similar positions, lends additional insight into why establishing independent organizations to pursue disruptive technology seems to be a necessary condition for success. S.S. Kresge, then the world's second-largest variety store chain, began studying discount retailing in 1957, while discounting was still in its infancy. By 1961, both Kresge and its rival, F.W. Woolworth, the world's largest variety store operator, had announced initiatives to enter discount retailing. Both firms opened stores in 1962, within 3 months of each other. The performance of the Woolco and Kmart ventures they launched, however, subsequently differed dramatically. A decade later, Kmart's sales approached $3.5 billion, while Woolco's sales were languishing unprofitably at $0.9 billion. In making its commitment to discount retailing, Kresge decided to exit the variety store business entirely. In 1959, it hired a new CEO, Harry Cunningham, whose sole mission was to convert Kresge into a discounting powerhouse. Cunningham, in turn, brought in an entirely new management team, so that by 1961 there was not a single operating vice president, regional manager, assistant regional manager, or regional merchandise manager who was not new on the job. In 1961, Cunningham stopped opening any new variety stores, embarking instead on a program of closing about 10% of Kresge's existing variety operations each year. This represented a wholesale refocusing of the company on discount retailing. Woolworth, on the other hand, attempted to support a program of sustaining improvements in technology, capacity, and facilities in its core variety store businesses while simultaneously investing in disruptive discounting. The managers charged with improving the performance of Woolworth's variety stores were also charged with building the largest chain of discount houses in America. CEO Robert Kirkwood asserted that Woolco would not conflict with the company's plans for growth and expansion in the regular variety store operations, and that no existing stores would be converted to a discount format. Indeed, as discount retailing hit its most frenzied expansion phase in the 1960s, Woolworth was opening new variety stores at the pace it had set in the 1950s. Unfortunately, but predictably, Woolworth proved unable to sustain within a single organization the two different cultures and two different models of how to make a profit that were required to be successful in variety and discount retailing. By 1967, it had dropped the term discount from all Woolco advertising, adopting the term promotional department store instead. Although initially Woolworth had set up a separate administrative staff for its Woolco operation, by 1971, more rational, cost-conscious heads had prevailed. In a move designed to increase sales per square foot in both Woolco and Woolworth divisions, the two subsidiaries have been consolidated operationally on a regional basis. Company officials say the consolidation, which involves buying offices, distribution facilities, and management personnel at the regional level, will help both to develop better merchandise and more efficient stores. Woolco will gain the benefits of Woolworth's buying resources, distribution facilities, and additional expertise in developing specialty departments.
In return, Woolworth will gain Woolco's know-how in locating, designing, promoting, and operating large stores over 100,000 square feet. What was the impact of this cost-saving consolidation? It provided more evidence that two models for how to make money cannot peacefully coexist within a single organization. Within a year of this consolidation, Woolco had increased its markups such that its gross margins were the highest in the discount industry, about 33%. In the process, its inventory turns fell from the 7 times it originally had achieved to 4 times. The formula for profit that had long sustained F.W. Woolworth, 35% margins for 4 inventory turns, or 140% return on inventory investment, was ultimately demanded of Woolco as well. Woolco was no longer a discounter, in name or in fact. Not surprisingly, Woolworth's venture into discount retailing failed. It closed its last Woolco store in 1982. Woolworth's organizational strategy for succeeding in disruptive discount retailing was the same as Digital Equipment's strategy for launching its personal computer business. Both founded new ventures within the mainstream organization that had to earn money by mainstream rules. And neither could achieve the cost structure and profit model required to succeed in the mainstream value network. Survival by suicide. Hewlett-Packard's LaserJet and Inkjet printers. Hewlett-Packard's experience in the personal computer printer business illustrates how a company's pursuit of a disruptive technology by spinning out an independent organization might entail, in the end, killing another of its business units. Hewlett-Packard's storied success in manufacturing printers for personal computers becomes even more remarkable when one considers its management of the emergence of bubblejet or inkjet technology. Beginning in the mid-1980s, HP began building a huge and successful business around laser jet printing technology. The laser jet was a discontinuous improvement over dot matrix printing, the previously dominant personal computer printing technology, and HP built a commanding market lead. When an alternative way of translating digital signals into images on paper, inkjet technology, first appeared, there were vigorous debates about whether laser jet or inkjet would emerge as the dominant design in personal printing. Experts lined up on both sides of the question, offering HP extensive advice on which technology would ultimately become the printer of choice on the world's desktops. Although it was never framed as such in the debates of the time, inkjet printing was a disruptive technology. It was slower than the laser jet, its resolution was worse, and its cost per printed page was higher. But the printer itself was smaller, and potentially much less expensive than the laser jet. At these lower prices, it promised lower gross margin dollars per unit than the laser jet. Thus, the inkjet printer was a classic disruptive product relative to the laser jet business. Rather than place its bet exclusively with one or the other, and rather than attempt to commercialize the disruptive inkjet from within the existing printer division in Boise, Idaho, HP created a completely autonomous organizational unit located in Vancouver, Washington, with responsibility for making the inkjet printer a success. It then let the two businesses compete against each other. Each has behaved classically. One study shows that the LaserJet division has moved sharply upmarket in a strategy reminiscent of 14-inch drives, mainframe computers, and integrated steel mills. HP's LaserJet printers can print at high speeds with exceptional resolution, handle hundreds of fonts and complicated graphics, print on two sides of the page, and serve multiple users on a network. They have also gotten larger physically. The inkjet printer isn't as good as the laser jet and may never be. But a critical question is whether the inkjet could ever be as good a printer as the personal desktop computing market demands. The answer appears to be yes. The resolution and speed of inkjet printers, while still inferior to those of laser jets, are now clearly good enough for many students, professionals, and other un-networked users of desktop computers. HP's inkjet printer business is now capturing many of those who would formerly have been laserjet users. Ultimately, the number of users at the highest performance end of the market, toward which the laserjet division is headed, will probably become small. One of HP's businesses may, in the end, have killed another. But had HP not set up its inkjet business as a separate organization, the inkjet technology would probably have languished within the mainstream laserjet business, leaving one of the other companies, now actively competing in the inkjet printer business, such as Canon, as a serious threat to HP's printer business. And by staying in the laser business as well, HP has joined IBM's mainframe business and the integrated steel companies in making a lot of money while executing an upmarket retreat. Chapter 6. Match the size of the organization to the size of the market. Managers who confront disruptive technological change must be leaders, not followers, in commercializing disruptive technologies. Doing so requires implanting the projects that are to develop such technologies in commercial organizations that match in size the market they are to address. These assertions are based on two key findings of this study: that leadership is more crucial in coping with disruptive technologies than with sustaining ones, and that small emerging markets cannot solve the near-term growth and profit requirements of large companies. The evidence from the disk drive industry shows that creating new markets is significantly less risky and more rewarding than entering established markets against entrenched competition. But as companies become larger and more successful, it becomes even more difficult to enter emerging markets early enough, because growing companies need to add increasingly large chunks of new revenue each year just to maintain their desired rate of growth. It becomes less and less possible that small markets can be viable as vehicles through which to find these chunks of revenue. As we shall see, the most straightforward way of confronting this difficulty is to implant projects aimed at commercializing disruptive technologies in organizations small enough to get excited about small market opportunities, and to do so on a regular basis, even while the mainstream company is growing. Are the pioneers really the ones with arrows in their backs? A crucial strategic decision in the management of innovation is whether it is important to be a leader or acceptable to be a follower. Volumes have been written on first-mover advantages and an offsetting amount on the wisdom of waiting until the innovation's major risks have been resolved by the pioneering firms. You can always tell who the pioneers were, an old management adage goes. They're the ones with the arrows in their backs. As with most disagreements in management theory, neither position is always right. Indeed, some findings from the study of the disk drive industry give some insight into when leadership is critical and when followership makes better sense. Leadership in sustaining technologies may not be essential. One of the watershed technologies affecting the pace at which disk drive makers have increased the recording density of their drives was the thin film read-write head. We heard in Chapter 1 that despite the radically different, competence-destroying character of the technology, the $100 million and 5 to 15 year expense of developing it, the firms that led in this technology were the leading established disk drive manufacturers. Because of the risk involved in the technology's development and its potential importance to the industry, the trade press began speculating in the late 1970s about which competitor would lead with thin film heads. How far might conventional ferrite head technology be pushed? Would any drive makers get squeezed out of the industry race because they placed a late or wrong bet on the new head technology? Yet it turned out whether a firm led or followed in this innovation did not make a substantial difference in its competitive position. One study shows when each of the leading firms introduced its first model employing thin film head technology. The vertical axis measures the recording density of the drive. The bottom end of the line for each firm denotes the maximum recording density it had achieved before it introduced a model with a thin film head. The top end of each line indicates the density of the first model each company introduced with a thin film head. Notice the wide disparity in the points at which the firms felt it was important to introduce the new technology. IBM led the industry, introducing its new head when it had achieved 3 megabits per square inch. Memorex and storage technology similarly took a leadership posture with respect to this technology. At the other end, Fujitsu and Hitachi pushed the performance of conventional ferrite heads nearly 10 times beyond the point where IBM first introduced the technology, choosing to be followers rather than leaders in thin film technology. What benefit, if any, did leadership in this technology give to the pioneers? There is no evidence that the leaders gained any significant competitive advantage over the followers. None of the firms that pioneered thin film technology gained significant market share on that account. In addition, pioneering firms appear not to have developed any sort of learning advantage, enabling them to leverage their early lead to attain higher levels of density than did followers. Evidence of this is displayed in another study. The horizontal axis shows the order in which the firms adopted thin film heads. Hence, IBM was the first, Memorex the second, and Fujitsu the 15th. The vertical axis gives the rank ordering of the recording density of the most advanced model marketed by each firm in 1989. If the early adopters of thin film heads enjoyed some sort of experience-based advantage over the late adopters, then we would expect the points in the chart to slope generally from the upper left toward the lower right. The study shows instead that there is no relationship between leadership and followership in thin film heads and any subsequent technological edge. Each of the other sustaining technologies in the industry's history present a similar picture. There is no evidence that any of the leaders in developing and adopting sustaining technologies developed a discernible competitive advantage over the followers. Leadership in disruptive technologies creates enormous value. In contrast to the evidence that leadership in sustaining technologies has historically conferred little advantage on the pioneering disk drive firms, there is strong evidence that leadership in disruptive technology has been very important. The companies that entered the new value networks enabled by disruptive generations of disk drives within the first 2 years after those drives appeared were 6 times more likely to succeed than those that entered later. 83 companies entered the U.S. disk drive industry between 1976 and 1993. 35 of these were diversified concerns, such as Memorex, Ampex, 3M, and Xerox, that made other computer peripheral equipment or other magnetic recording products. 48 were independent startup companies, many being financed by venture capital and headed by people who previously had worked for other firms in the industry. These numbers represent the complete census of all firms that ever were incorporated and or were known to have announced the design of a hard drive, whether or not they actually sold any. It is not a statistical sample of firms that might be biased in favor or against any type of firm. The entry strategies employed by each of these firms can be characterized along the two axes in a table. The vertical axis describes technology strategies, with firms at the bottom using only proven technologies in their initial products, and those at the top using one or more new component technologies. The horizontal axis charts market strategies, with firms at the left having entered already established value networks, and those at the right having entered emerging value networks. Another way to characterize this matrix is to note that companies that were aggressive at entry in developing and adopting sustaining innovations appear in the two top boxes, left and right, while companies that led at entry in creating new value networks appear in the two right-hand boxes, top and bottom. The companies in the right boxes include all companies that attempted to create new value networks, even those networks that did not materialize into substantial markets, such as removable hard drives. Each quadrant displays the number of companies that entered using the strategy represented. Under the S for success are the number of firms that successfully generated $100 million in revenues in at least 1 year, even if the firm subsequently failed. F for failure shows the number of firms that failed ever to reach the $100 million revenue threshold and that have subsequently exited the industry. N for no indicates the number of firms for which there is as yet no verdict because, while still operating in 1994, they had not yet reached $100 million in sales. And T for total lists the total number of firms that entered in each category. The column labeled percentage success indicates the percentage of the total number of firms that reached $100 million in sales. Finally, beneath the matrix are the sums of the data in the two quadrants above. The numbers beneath the matrix show that only 3 of the 51 firms, 6%, that entered established markets ever reached the $100 million revenue benchmark. In contrast, 37% of the firms that led in disruptive technological innovation, those entering markets that were less than 2 years old, surpassed the $100 million level, as shown on the right side of the table. Whether a firm was a startup or a diversified firm had little impact on its success rate. What mattered appears not to have been its organizational form, but whether it was a leader in introducing disruptive products and creating the markets in which they were sold. Only 13% of the firms that entered attempting to lead in sustaining component technologies, the top half of the matrix, succeeded, while 20% of the firms that followed were successful. Clearly, the lower right quadrant offered the most fertile ground for success. The cumulative sales numbers in the rightmost columns in each quadrant show the total cumulative revenues logged by all firms pursuing each of the strategies. These are summarized below the matrix. The result is quite stunning. The firms that led in launching disruptive products together logged a cumulative total of $62 billion in revenues between 1976 and 1994. Those that followed into the markets later, after those markets had become established, logged only $3.3 billion in total revenue. It is indeed an innovator's dilemma. Firms that sought growth by entering small, emerging markets logged 20 times the revenues of the firms pursuing growth in larger markets. The difference in revenues per firm is even more striking. The firms that followed late into the markets, enabled by disruptive technology, on the left half of the matrix, generated an average cumulative total of $64.5 million per firm. The average company that led in disruptive technology generated $1.9 billion in revenues. The firms on the left side seem to have made a sour bargain. They exchanged a market risk, the risk that an emerging market for the disruptive technology might not develop after all, for a competitive risk, the risk of entering markets against entrenched competition. Company size and leadership in disruptive technologies. Despite evidence that leadership in disruptive innovation pays such huge dividends, established firms, as we heard in the first 4 chapters of this book, often fail to take the lead. Customers of established firms can hold the organizations captive, working through rational, well-functioning resource allocation processes to keep them from commercializing disruptive technologies. One cruel additional disabling factor that afflicts established firms as they work to maintain their growth rate is that the larger and more successful they become, the more difficult it is to muster the rationale for entering an emerging market in its early stages, when the evidence aforementioned shows that entry is so crucial. Good managers are driven to keep their organizations growing for many reasons. One is that growth rates have a strong effect on share prices. To the extent that a company's stock price represents the discounted present value of some consensus forecast of its future earnings stream, then the level of the stock price, whether it goes up or down,
is driven by changes in the projected rate of growth in earnings. In other words, if a company's current share price is predicated on a consensus growth forecast of 20%, and the market's consensus for growth is subsequently revised downward to 15% growth, then the company's share price will likely fall, even though its revenues and earnings will still be growing at a healthy rate. A strong and increasing stock price, of course, gives a company access to capital on favorable terms. Happy investors are a great asset to a company. Rising share prices make stock option plans an inexpensive way to provide incentive to and to reward valuable employees. When share prices stagnate or fall, options lose their value. In addition, company growth creates room at the top for high-performing employees to expand the scope of their responsibilities. When companies stop growing, they begin losing many of their most promising future leaders, who see less opportunity for advancement. Finally, there is substantial evidence that growing companies find it much easier to justify investments in new product and process technologies than do companies whose growth has stopped. Unfortunately, companies that become large and successful find that maintaining growth becomes progressively more difficult. The math is simple. A $40 million company that needs to grow profitably at 20% to sustain its stock price and organizational vitality needs an additional $8 million in revenues the first year, $9.6 million the following year, and so on. A $400 million company with a 20% targeted growth rate needs new business worth $80 million in the first year, $96 million in the next, and so on. And a $4 billion company with a 20% goal needs to find $800 million, $960 million, and so on in each successive year. The problem is particularly vexing for big companies confronting disruptive technologies. Disruptive technologies facilitate the emergence of new markets, and there are no $800 million emerging markets. But it is precisely when emerging markets are small, when they are least attractive to large companies in search of big chunks of new revenue, that entry into them is so critical. How can a manager of a large, successful company deal with these realities of size and growth when confronted by disruptive change? I have observed three approaches in my study of this problem. 1. Try to affect the growth rate of the emerging market so that it becomes big enough, fast enough, to make a meaningful dent on the trajectory of profit and revenue growth of a large company. 2. Wait until the market has emerged and become better defined, and then enter after it has become large enough to be interesting. 3. Place responsibility to commercialize disruptive technologies in organizations small enough that their performance will be meaningfully affected by the revenues, profits, and small orders flowing from the disruptive business in its earliest years. As the following case studies show, the first two approaches are fraught with problems. The third has its share of drawbacks too, but offers more evidence of promise. Case study: pushing the growth rate of an emerging market. The history of Apple Computer's early entry into the handheld computer, or personal digital assistant, PDA, market, helps to clarify the difficulties confronting large companies in small markets. Apple Computer introduced its Apple I in 1976. It was, at best, a preliminary product with limited functionality, and the company sold a total of 200 units at $666 each before withdrawing it from the market. But the Apple I wasn't a financial disaster. Apple had spent modestly on its development, and both Apple and its customers learned a lot about how desktop personal computers might be used. Apple incorporated this learning into its Apple II computer, introduced in 1977, which was highly successful. Apple sold 43,000 Apple II computers in the first 2 years they were on the market, and the product's success positioned the company as the leader in the personal computer industry. On the basis of the Apple II's success, Apple went public in 1980. A decade after the release of the Apple II, Apple Computer had grown into a $5 billion company, and like all large and successful companies, it found itself having to add large chunks of revenue each year to preserve its equity value and organizational vitality. In the early 1990s, the emerging market for handheld PDAs presented itself as a potential vehicle for achieving that needed growth. In many ways, this opportunity, analogous to that in 1978, when the Apple II computer helped shape its industry, was a great fit for Apple. Apple's distinctive design expertise was in user-friendly products, and user-friendliness and convenience were the basis of the PDA concept. How did Apple approach this opportunity? Aggressively. It invested scores of millions of dollars to develop its product, dubbed the Newton. The Newton's features were defined through one of the most thoroughly executed market research efforts in corporate history. Focus groups and surveys of every type were used to determine what features consumers would want. The PDA had many of the characteristics of a disruptive computing technology, and recognizing the potential problems, Apple CEO John Sculley made the Newton's development a personal priority, promoting the product widely, and ensuring that the effort got the technical and financial resources it needed. Apple sold 140,000 Newtons in 1993 and 1994, its first 2 years on the market. Most observers, of course, viewed the Newton as a big flop. Technically, its handwriting recognition capabilities were disappointing, and its wireless communications technologies had made it expensive. But what was most damning was that while Sculley had publicly positioned the Newton as a key product to sustain the company's growth, its first-year sales amounted to about 1% of Apple's revenues. Despite all the effort, the Newton made hardly a dent in Apple's need for new growth. But was the Newton a failure? The timing of Newton's entry into the handheld market was akin to the timing of the Apple II into the desktop market. It was a market-creating, disruptive product targeted at an undefinable set of users whose needs were unknown to either themselves or Apple. On that basis, Newton's sales should have been a pleasant surprise to Apple's executives. It outsold the Apple II in its first 2 years by a factor of more than 3 to 1. But while selling 43,000 units was viewed as an IPO-qualifying triumph in the smaller Apple of 1979, selling 140,000 Newtons was viewed as a failure in the giant Apple of 1994. As Chapter 7 will show, disruptive technologies often enable something to be done that previously had been deemed impossible. Because of this, when they initially emerge, neither manufacturers nor customers know how or why the products will be used, and hence, do not know what specific features of the product will and will not ultimately be valued. Building such markets entails a process of mutual discovery by customers and manufacturers, and this simply takes time. In Apple's development of the desktop computer, for example, the Apple I failed, the first Apple II was lackluster, and the Apple II Plus succeeded. The Apple III was a market failure because of quality problems, and the Lisa was a failure. The first two generations of the Macintosh computer also stumbled. It wasn't until the third iteration of the Macintosh that Apple and its customers finally found it, the standard for convenient, user-friendly computing to which the rest of the industry ultimately had to conform. In launching the Newton, however, Apple was desperate to short-circuit this coalescent process for defining the ultimate product and market. It assumed that its customers knew what they wanted and spent very aggressively to find out what this was. As the next chapter will show, this is impossible. Then, to give customers what they thought they wanted, Apple had to assume the precarious role of a sustaining technology leader in an emerging industry. It spent enormous sums to push mobile data communications and handwriting recognition technologies beyond the state of the art. And finally, it spent aggressively to convince people to buy what it had designed. Because emerging markets are small by definition, the organizations competing in them must be able to become profitable at small scale. This is crucial because organizations or projects that are perceived as being profitable and successful can continue to attract financial and human resources, both